This is a beautiful, beautiful, very sensitive book, The Tongues of Angels. I know you had been working on this because I read in the introduction to Clear Pictures that you had been asked to do a novella, and it turned out to be a novel. Can you give me a little of the background of Tongues of Angels?
The real background is that when I was 20 years old, between my sophomore and junior years in Duke University, I worked for a summer, for 10 weeks in the summer, as a counselor in a boys' camp in the North Carolina mountains. And I had never written anything that alluded to or came out of that experience. And suddenly, about 3 years ago, I just really, for whatever reasons, began thinking about that time and about how rich it had been and wonderful and funny and dumb and moving, and started making elaborate notes, just memory notes. And that turned into a novel, which... because the plot of the novel is not exactly a happy one, I'm very glad to say it's an entirely invented story. But the background, the camp life that goes on around this fictional story, certainly is very representative of the camp that I knew back in 1953.
Oh, it was wonderful, because in the 1950s I also went to Boy Scout camp in Ohio. It didn't seem to have the philosophical and religious overtones, the great spirit overtones in the Tongues of Angels, but certainly farting was a great it was a great part of camp life, and it was really an experience. So I equated to the camp with these boys. But of course, you were a counselor, not actually a
student. I was a counselor. I had been a camper. I only went one summer, the summer that I was 12 years old, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it was at a different camp. But at least I had the two sides of the whole camping experience. I'd been a camper at 12, and then 8 years later at 20, I was a counselor. So I saw that great American institution from two sides. And you mentioned the sort of spiritual elements in the Tongues of Angels. They're very much part of the real camp that I attended, which had been founded and was run when I was there by a wonderful old man who had a passionate interest not only in woodsmanship and outdoorsmanship, but also in Christianity and in Indian lore. And Indian lore, taught very responsibly by a Sioux Indian who came each year to camp, was a very big feature of the whole organization of all the activities. And it revived my own longtime childhood interest in the American Indian, and that's gone on. It's one of the legacies of that summer for me. It's been a continuing fascination with the American Indian, the history of the Indian, and the plight of the American Indian today.
Tell me about your main character, which you said is made up of Raphael, a very special, special young man.
I've known through the years, especially as a teacher, I've taught at Duke for 32 years now, I've known a number of extraordinary young men and young women, and I've taught them in their adolescence, their late adolescence, when they were sort of 18 or so, and have, in the case of some of the most extraordinary ones, realized that period of their lives, rather sadly, was the best period, that everything from there on was downhill for them. That's not the rule, but it's been a fascinating and kind of awesome exception that I can think of several examples of. There's no original of the boy Raphael in the novel. There was no real life original, but he's a sort of amalgam of a lot of extraordinary kids I've known who didn't manage to make it out of childhood. And in this case, in the case of Raphael in my novel, he doesn't make it out of childhood. It's no fault of his own. There are other circumstances that beset him, his own past and an accident that happens in the present.
Extremely precocious kid, way beyond his years.
He is, and the narrator, who's a counselor, very late in the novel, discovers the great secret that has shaped Raphael's whole life, and that partly explains, I think, his real precocity. I tried very hard to make him an entirely credible character, to be a credible 14-year-old, at the same time that it's clear that he's also an extraordinary person. And so far, I've not been challenged by anyone saying they thought he was incredible, so that pleases me.
Oh, there's some very nice touches in the book, too, the trip to Asheville and Thomas Wolfe's home. And so many memorable lines. Actually, you don't remember them so much as you feel them as you read. There's a line, for example, on page 168 that I recall, that where you describe the camp as being as quiet as an old battlefield. I wish I could use that. Can I steal that one?
You're welcome to that. Yeah, I visited a lot of battlefields, especially the Civil War battlefields in the South. It's a good Southerner. It's been part of my whole childhood and early youth to visit various battlefields. And I do think that very often now the battlefields still tend to be out in the country. Appomattox, where the war ended, of course, is in the Virginia countryside, not terribly far from where I live in North Carolina. And, of course, Bruce Catton's famous book, The Stillness at Appomattox. Well, to this day, if one goes to Appomattox, it's one of the stillest places in the world, this lovely little country crossroads where Lee and Grant met to end the bloodiest war to this day that America has ever fought. They do seem to have earned their peace and their stillness through these extraordinary moments of awful carnage which occurred in those places.
Now, the Tongues of Angels is steeped in spirituality. Can you tell me a little bit about these spiritual overtones that permeate this book?
Well, as I said, I think in the case of the particular camp in which I worked, those overtones were a natural extension of the man who founded and managed the camp, a wonderful man named C. Walton Johnson, who's long dead. In fact, he was in his 60s when I worked for him in 1953. But I think it was a kind of intensity that was fairly common in this country, really right on down into the terrific disillusionment that overtook us with the failure in Vietnam, the tragic experience of Vietnam, this sort of muscular YMCA kind of active Christianity, which was not fundamentalist or evangelical, but was very much a sort of get up and shine your light before men and help the lives of others. It wasn't, for any reason, I don't think, a dangerous or a unnerving kind of violent religiosity of the sort that we've seen in a good deal lately. But I think it was a kind of innocence that mixed in with all of this Indian lore and learning how to use the axe and also learning a good deal of respect for the environment. I mean, the first time I was ever made aware of the fact that man is a wasteful and destructive creature really was in the lectures we would get from Chief at the camp where I worked in 53. So it was a...
He was also called Chief?
He was called Chief, yes, the real man. So it was a very rich experience. It was also, I think, as occurs in the novel, and I don't want to forecast the plot, but it was a kind of atmosphere in which a particular kind of young man, young counselor, or older boy, as in the case of Rayfield, who's 14, could really get perhaps a little too enthusiastic about. And that, of course, is one of the complications of the novel, the way this rich blend of schoolboy fun and hijinks and Indian lore and religion all mingle to produce a rich and exciting atmosphere, which occasionally got out of control.
Now, you grew up in a religious household. What was that like, and how did that ultimately affect your work?
Well, my parents were both Protestant Christians. My father was Baptist, and my mother was Methodist. They were what I would call very convinced believers, but by no means evangelical or fundamentalist. They were people who led tremendously decent and generous-hearted lives, but were very far from being condemnatory or judgmental on the lives of others around them. And we did go to churches, but church was not a central feature of our family life. And so I think both my brother and I, there were only two of us, really grew up in an atmosphere in which religion was fairly quietly central to the family's life, certainly central to my father in his successful attempt to stop drinking after I was born in 1933, and it was there very much in our lives, but it was not talked about and insisted on in a way now that I think turns off so many young Americans. When they think of religion, they can really think only of television evangelism or of someone they know down the street who is terribly judgmental and abusive to them.
Is it important to you now, especially with the paraplegia, or have you just abandoned it?
I really, in my own late teens, and largely because of a tremendous disaffection with the way that the Southern Protestant Church dealt with civil rights issues when they began to rise powerfully in the 60s, the white church is the most segregated place in America, and certainly in the South, and continues to be even after all these years. But I really, at that time, lost my interest in belonging to a particular institution called a church. I've certainly maintained my own religious faith and have written a good deal about it, and it's very central to my life, both before and after the paraplegia that you allude to, which so overtook me about 6 years ago now. Again, it's a deep conviction, but not one that I go around clapping and shouting about.
Now, race relations, as you grew up, you touch upon this in your memoir, Clear Pictures, because you had a number, and your family had a number of black friends. Can you tell me what that was like as a Southerner being faced with overt segregation during that day?
Overt was hardly the word. So far as public life was concerned, certainly transport, schooling, access to the simplest kinds of social facilities, segregation was total. At a deeper, and as it turns out, crucially important level, there was the fact that very few white families did not have close daily contact with black people. A family did not have to be even moderately well off. The simplest lower middle class family normally had a cook in the kitchen and probably a black man who came by at least one afternoon a week to rake the lawn or mow the grass or whatever. So with varying degrees of intensity, I think most Southerners from my own background, which is middle class white, grew up in the presence and in really an intimate contact with black people. So there was always, however unjust the system, however horribly unjust, there was always dialogue going on. I think one of the appalling things that we feel about segregation, for instance, in the American Northeast now, which is the most segregated place in the country and probably the place with the strongest racial hostilities, I think what we feel is the fact that there's never been any sort of dialogue, that most middle-class white people or blue-collar white people have simply never had contact with blacks except in a context of fear and profound alienation from one another.
But don't you think the situation here in the Northeast is a little different, though, because we're talking about neighborhoods, I hate to use the term ghetto, but you're talking about isolated neighborhoods such as Bensonhurst, which is Italian, you know. They're talking about turf and separation. And in the South, I don't know that that was the case. It seemed to be either all black or all white.
Well, certainly in the South, even in a number of small towns in which we live, there were always the black part of town. Where you went to take the cook home after dinner on a hot summer evening. But
you didn't have an Italian neighborhood.
You didn't have an Italian neighborhood, no. I mean, the South consisted basically of Anglo-Saxons, of Scotch-Irish, a few Jews who really did not constitute an excluded minority in the South, perhaps because there were so few Jews. I mean, I grew up going to school with a number of Jewish children and really feeling very little sense of difference from them, feeling a great sense of warmth. In the case of the whole black-white thing in the South, yes, you're quite right, it's absolutely different from the rest of the country. But I would say that the degree of integration in the workplace and the degree of social integration and in public schools that's occurred in the South in the last 20, 25 years, I absolutely, if you'd asked me 25 years ago if this could happen, I'd have said, you're crazy. There's going to be an awful lot of thousands of dead people, black and white, before this ends, with the tragic exception of a few dozen people, really, over the last 30 years. A peaceful revolution occurred in the South. There's an enormous amount of justice that remains to be done. But I do think that in ways that were completely unforeseeable, portions of the South are more successfully integrated than any other parts of the country that I know of.
I think you're right. You rarely hear about any racial problems, yeah. Mostly in these big cities with their ethnic neighborhoods.
Yeah.
I have this theory that you grew up in small towns, and I have this theory that small town life is probably a wonderful thing for a writer because he has the chance to see intimately friends and neighbors, relatives, close up in a way that in a big city like New York you just don't. So I guess the question is, what impact might small town life have had on you as a writer?
Well, I never had quite thought of it that way, and I think you've got to be absolutely right. Until I was a grown man and gone off to graduate school to live in Oxford, England, which is a large city, I had never lived in a town larger than Raleigh, North Carolina, which was, at the time that I lived there, in the 40s and 50s, was a town of 50,000. And it was still the kind of city which I could prowl safely in my bicycle with my friends on summer days. There was no sense of threat. There was no sense of danger. Once again, in the old cliche, no one ever felt the necessity to lock doors to houses. So I think you're right. A whole array of the world, from the very poor to the very wealthy, was laid out before a child for his observation and his learning in a way that very few American youngsters now have available to them. There was very little sense of alienation. Of course, any child, especially any adolescent, invents his own enemies and the things that he's afraid of. But there are an awful lot more things to be legitimately afraid of in America in the 1990s than there ever were in the North Carolina of the 1940s and 50s when I was growing up.
But in a small town, in a neighborhood in a small town, you got to know all the neighbors. I mean, if the neighbors down the street were fighting, the husband moved out. Everybody knew about it.
You knew all about that, exactly. And there might be the cranky old neighbor down the street who didn't want you walking across his lawn or whatever, so you learned about that. And there might be the slightly dotty old lady living in the upstairs of her house. You got to know this. So, indeed, there was this exposure, this involvement in a wide range of life. Another thing, of course, that wasn't necessarily special to small towns, but was very available to us, thank God, was an access to people who were older than our parents. We had these extended families of grandparents and sometimes great-grandparents and old aunts and uncles who provided us, again, with this knowledge about human beings who were older than adolescent or older than our parents. So many of the students whom I teach now at Duke University between the ages of 18 and 22, so many of them simply don't know anyone older than their parents who are, let's say, in their early 40s by now. So it's a strange predicament that we've created in America, a generation of young people who have no idea what it's like to be older than 40.
Well, I have a new neighbor across the hall from me in my apartment building. I have never seen this neighbor. I sometimes hear some classical music behind the doors, and his bathroom abuts mine, so I can sometimes hear running water, but I have never seen that person. And I can go down the elevator with people I've never said hello to. Now, that's a far cry from growing up in Macon, isn't that true?
Absolutely. A tremendous
and worse.
Cry. No, and if I had to make a choice, obviously I would choose growing up in a community where one was surrounded by people who, however batty or however even scary they might be at intervals, were essentially no threat at all.
And if you lose your privacy.
You lose a lot of privacy, and I spent a great deal of time. I was an only child until I was 8, and then my brother was born. I spent a great deal of time learning how to use that loneliness that I had as an only child, and that in itself gave me, kind of unconsciously, a sort of mastery of the art of getting private. I learned fairly soon in my life how to live behind a shut door. And that's never been a tremendous problem with me ever since, thank goodness. I know it is for a huge number of other writers and other human beings.
I know you don't like to refer to yourself as a Southern writer, but there is a sense of community or belonging that one, I assume one feels in the South, that you just don't feel elsewhere. Now, I grew up in the Midwest, and also a portion of my childhood was in Texas. I don't consider myself a Texan. I hardly consider myself a Midwesterner. I have a feeling that in the Midwest, there's not that sense of belonging. But the South, there seems to be some sort of unity of spirit and intellect and dialect even. And I think that's why I would be proud to say I'm a Southern writer.
Yeah. Well, I really am. I think there are times when I realize that people are using the label as a kind of reductive label, which sort of implies that you might turn up on Grand Ole Opry next week as a hillbilly. But no, I have ultimately come to realize that the rest of the country thinks of the South as being not quite the United States. And as far as that goes, they are right. The South is so distinctive. Even now, after 25, 30 years of tremendous economic change and of the settlement of the South by a great many other Americans from elsewhere in the country, there is a sort of unique atmosphere and aroma, especially if you get outside the large cities and if you get off the interstate highways. There's a very distinctive feel and culture, which for good or bad, and there are great quantities of both, is so much unlike the rest of the nation that I begin finally in my latter years to understand why Southerners are really called Southerners. And I noticed all the obituaries of Walker Percy last week. Every single headline said Southern novelist dies. Well, you wouldn't have said Northeastern novelist dies, or Midwestern novelist dies, or California novelist dies. So I guess we simply have to lie back and realize that the rest of the country is trying to describe us as what we are, which is Americans or citizens of the United States, but with a decided difference.
I would bask in it. I think it's a wonderful thing. Well, tell me about, give me a medical report, because it's been a couple of years since I've seen you, and you're still getting around in the wheelchair. What's been going on?
Well, I still have, my original problem was a spinal tumor, malignant spinal tumor, which was first operated on and radiated in 1984, and I've had three more surgeries since then. I took the legal limit of radiation at the beginning and can have no more of that. But my condition has been absolutely clear since then. I have an annual scan of my spine, and so far, so fine. No further symptoms. I lost the use of my legs in the summer of 1984 and have lived entirely in a wheelchair since then. I have no use of my legs whatever. But I certainly don't claim to be recovered. I'd have to knock on all the wood in the world before I could say that. But my health is excellent, and there's no visible cloud on the horizon. I'm a 57-year-old man, and there are certain things that I can't do, but they are mostly the things that most 57-year-old men can't do.
Tell me about it. How do you, I noticed that you are using some young men to help you. How does this work exactly?
Well, I've been incredibly lucky ever since my legs were paralyzed in late 1984. I've been very lucky that I've had an assistant who's been able to live in my home in a separate apartment of his own and really help me live my life, do the cooking and help me when I go on the road and take trips and with the kinds of chores around the house and around town that are not easily doable by someone in a wheelchair. And each person has, they've often been former students of mine, each person has spent at least a year doing the job, so I've been extremely blessed in not having to go out really and look for professional help personnel. And I, because each one has stayed at least a year, I haven't had to keep training new people in all the little skills of how to deal with someone who lives in a wheelchair. So again, I feel like a very lucky man.
How is this affecting your ability to teach?
I still teach absolutely what I always did. I've always taught one semester a year at Duke University. I teach a writing course of some description or other, short story or long story, sometimes poetry. I teach to upperclassmen and to graduate students. I enjoy it tremendously. I do that 4 months a year, which takes up pretty much of my time and energy during that 4 months. So the rest of the year, the other 8 months, I am fairly exclusively socked in writing my novels and poems and plays and whatever.
Apparently your energy level hasn't died. This is now The Tongues of Angels is your third book in 3 years.
And I've got two more that are presently in press, a new book of poems for the fall and this trilogy of plays that was produced in Cleveland in the fall at the Cleveland Playhouse. No, I do. I spend more hours. I have more hours available to me because, as I said, there's this kind person who goes and gets the groceries and the laundry and saves me all the energy that those chores leak away in most of our lives. Luckily, with that extra time, I've had the energy to be able to stay at the processor and process these words on out. And I've enjoyed this aspect of it, certainly, enormously, that I've worked faster and I hope no worse than I ever have before.
Does it, do the words come out just as easily? I mean, you're a veteran writer now. Does it get harder? Does it get easier? Do you find that, gee, I don't have anything more to say, or what happened? Well, obviously you have more to say because the words keep spewing out, but tell me about, as a writer matures, how does he adapt to this work?
Well, you're right. It's something like the question of my health. It's something I don't want to lean on too hard or make any advanced claims about, but I have written an extraordinary amount in the last 5 or 6 years. I was never a terribly slow writer, but I've been a speeded up writer since. I don't know why. I'm not looking at it too hard for fear it'll go away. I would have to say that if I think back to the early days in which I was writing full-time, which is when I was started when I was about 22 years old, I would have to say that now, 35 years later, writing is a great deal easier for me than it was then. It's almost pure pleasure for me now, and I can remember the terrible agonies of learning how to do this or that when I was much younger. I'm not saying I've learned everything there is, because I'm constantly learning. But I'm taking a kind of pleasure in the learning, and I think I've got control of a certain number of basic elementary skills that I didn't control when I was much younger, and those are the skills of how and when to work, and basically how to find my own subjects, and I'm tremendously grateful for that.
Well, in almost every book I read, I discover a new word. In The Tongues of Angels, I discovered a word called fantods. Can you tell me about fantods?
Well, fantods, I put it in the novel. Rafe at some point says something gives him the fantods, and the narrator says, I didn't know anyone but Huck Finn ever had the fantods. And that expressed all I knew about fantods up to that point, because indeed, in Huckleberry Finn, numerous times Huck says, I had to get out of there because the widow was giving me the fantods. And I just assumed it meant I was just getting fed up, I was getting bored. So a friend called me last week and said, I love the word fantods. What does it mean? And I, at that point, finally hied myself to the Oxford English Dictionary and found out that the word fantods, indeed, one of the very earliest citations given for it is Huckleberry Finn, late in the 19th century. But it seems to be a form of the word fatigue by elaborate distance, that this just bored me, bored the hell out of me, or this was boring me so hard, fatiguing me so much, that I had to get away. So I hope that I can personally reintroduce the fantods back into American slang.
Now, wait, I looked at my Flunk and Wagnalls after I came across fantods, and it also has a definition. The word means give one the willies.
Exactly. It's anything from boring one to death to giving one the willies to making one feel creepy. I think it's a very broad range of things. Apparently, it did originally was the idea of boredom or fatigue, but now it's even broader.
Gives me the fantods to think about it. Tongues of Angels, it's a beautiful book, Reynolds Price. Thank you very much.
Thank you.